I would massively appreciate if you enjoy this podcast that you would leave a review or just hit 5 stars, ideally, or 1 star, if that's how you feel about it. I do appreciate honest feedback. Thank you so much.
Hi there.
Hi, Maddie.
How are you?
Unbelievable, thanks.
Good.
So, yeah, thanks for agreeing to speak to me. And the reason you came to my attention is we have an organic croft that Mum and Dad have been active on for 50 years. And we have woof, you know, organic people, farm workers come from all over the world, volunteers.
Yeah.
It was a copy of Permaculture magazine, which I'd never seen before, on one of my recent trips home. And I picked it up and started reading it, and it was your opening editorial piece, including about your husband, and it called me an old softy, moved me to tears, and it moved me to get in touch. So, yeah, what's your story? Well, yourself and Tim's story, I guess.
In what sense? Do you want to put the story in context?
It's an open question. I'm just interested in how there was a magazine that caught my attention like that.
Okay.
Sat on Mum's croft house table.
Yeah.
Drawing us together as if the universe or the plants had intended us to have this conversation. I don't know.
Okay. So, back in the early 90s, we were exploring the idea of restoring a piece of arable farmland that was without topsoil and had been completely hammered to the point where there was just no soil life at all. And it was just clay and flint, and the only things that could grow in it were arable crops that were, you know, saturated in fertilizer and pesticides. And we acquired this piece of land. And then Tim and I watched a TV program on Channel 4 called In Grave Danger of Falling Food. And it was all about an Australian guy called Bill Mollison, who co-originated the permaculture concept, which is a concept of, first of all, it began with permanent agriculture and the idea that our agricultural system was just totally destroying soil and not capturing water, but just causing massive problems with sedimentation and runoff and a loss of fertility on a global scale, particularly relevant though to Australia, which has sort of inherited a European form of agriculture that's caused devastation and the growth of non-native species like brambles and rabbits that have sort of run riot across that old fragile landscape. And we were looking after this field and turning it into a wildflower meadow from a very dead arable field. And suddenly we thought, wow, we could have our wildlife conservation project, but we could also grow food and be more resilient and sustainable. And so the sort of permaculture light bulb went off. And at this time in the UK, there weren't any books about permaculture for a northern temperate climate. They were all Australian. But there was a newsletter called Permaculture Works. So we contacted the national charity, the Permaculture Association, and said, hi, we're here. We're publishers. What can we do? How can we help? Because we just thought it was such a stunning and brilliant idea. to have a design system that could help ordinary people, not specialists, design gardens and farms and communities to become ultimately regenerative, not just sustainable. So that was how it all started. And the Permaculture Association asked us to take on the newsletter, and we said, yeah, well, we will, but it needs to be a magazine and it needs to be something that anyone can get hold of, not just members, because we need to get this out there into the world. So, you know, with huge amount of optimism and naivety yeah. and foolish youthful enthusiasm, that's what we did.
Youthful enthusiasm and naive optimism has caused many great things to happen.
Well done. Well, you have less fear, don't you? You don't sort of process the consequences of your foolish and optimistic actions.
Why else would anyone have children? Well, if it wasn't for naive optimism.
The magazine has been a child. And then we started, by 1993, we started publishing books under the imprint of Permanent Publications. And we've done well in excess of over 100, not just about permaculture and permaculture design, but about all aspects of sustainable living, from renewables and DIY 12-volt solar, and how to convert your septic tank into a sort of ecological reed bed system, and all that kind of wonderful stuff, but also about designing regenerative, healthy cultures and subjects like that that aren't land-based and are more about people and building positive and creative relationships, not only on an individualistic basis, but within community and within society. So we work closely with one author, for example, called Luby McNamara, who is really the first person in the world to publish a permaculture book, not about land-based permaculture, but about the second ethic of permaculture, which is people care. So how do we look after people? Because it's often people in projects and in life that, you know, we humans have a good way of slightly making things more complicated and more stressful and more conflict-ridden. So it's about ways of navigating our relationships, large and small, to be more creative and productive and harmonious.
Yeah, ain't that the truth, that humans have a way of overcomplicating and creating conflict where there's no need for conflict? That is just so true. The reason that I've become recently more engaged with, so I'm actually, although I was brought up on that croft, I left age 11 to go to school because it's on a tiny island. And then since then, you know, I went to university and I've worked away and had business in mainland Scotland and, well, have worked all over the world. So it's been fairly recent that I've really started to deeply re-engage with the land. And so I'm a newbie who's probably ripe for a top three steps from Maddie in a minute. But what got me to re-engage truly was a couple of, well, one in particular, plant medicine experiences, let's call it, where I was taken back to my childhood and to that relationship with the earth, Mother Earth, if you like, the divine feminine creative force, which to some listening might sound a bit woo-woo, as I have some managing directors and CEOs who will be listening to this pod, but it's the truth. So, yeah, what's your, I mean, there's so many directions this could go. I'm fascinated by this idea of a healthy culture. My mother was quoted in Woman's Own in 1974, just after they'd got there. And the quote I always remember is, "Where things grow, there is hope." But to me, they've grown a lot of people there over the years, as well as organic food. They've run a drug rehab there, which I was involved in, and they've had all kinds of waifs and strays show up. What's this piece about healthy culture? Can you dip into that a little bit more? Because I love that as a basic concept, but what is it? Is it communism? What is it? How do we get there?
Oh, I don't think it's a political system necessarily.
I'm done with politics.
I think it's about connection and relationship, and being part of a community, however modest. That doesn't mean being a communard, but, you know, and living in a intentional community necessarily. But, you know, as you've observed, your parents have created tremendous amount of community and nurturing, and they've grown people as well as vegetables. And that is sort of the essence for me. But to be able to do that, we have to be comfortable in our own skin. So I think it's really important that we all, first of all, look at what do we want to do with our lives, and have clarity about the direction that we're going in, and secondly, be aware of the impacts that we have on other people, and work on that aspect of things. And you know, the cliche is that, you know, when you're on your deathbed, you don't think about how much money you've made, you don't think about how many cars you own, you think about your relationships and the people that you love and who you're leaving. So I think the deeper philosophy is to try and live that with that kind of awareness on a daily basis. But that doesn't mean that you can't be a successful, motivated person that's fulfilling their potential. It just means that your framing of your potential is not just utterly materialistic and selfish. It is about relationship and connection. And if we do this as individuals, it percolates out into our local community and into the wider world. And it's very sustaining. You don't burn out because you're in, you know, you observe this phenomena of nature that is very nurturing and very energizing and holds us. And when we are working for good things, and the betterment of our fellow human being and our environment, we receive back so much. And it's very important, you know, the basis of permaculture is ethical. There's three ethics: earth care, people care, and the third ethic could be deemed as future care or limits to growth or fair shares.
That's right, fair share. So yeah, how so I love what you're saying, it resonates with me. But as soon as you start using words that aren't growth, most, you know, Western economies seem to think that growth is what has to happen at all times. Otherwise, who knows what happens? The sky falls in or something. Maybe it does due to the monetary system. Like, how sustainable is this?
Yeah, I mean, how sustainable is the concept of completely unethical growth? So the growth in our society that we're viewing at the moment is a small percentage of growth in a small percentage of the population. It's very, very obvious that it is not touching most human beings in our society. You know, if you look at, say dental care, which was on the news yesterday, there are children in our schools in the southwest of England, aged 6 and 7, who have never seen a dentist because there isn't an NHS dentist. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just stupid. It's stupid to bring up a generation without healthcare. That the NHS was this enormous step forward in society and in caring for people. And by privatizing so much of it and removing the service, we change the trajectory of health of an entire generation. And it's not for the better. And so I look at the growth economy, and I don't see a growth economy for most people. I only see a growth economy for a very few privileged percent, and the rest of it is struggle. And I also think that nature teaches us that there is a tremendous abundance in life, but we're taught to think in terms of scarcity. We're taught to think that human evolution is all about competition and fight. We're not taught to see symbiosis and the other aspects of what I would call sharing. And I think when we enter a different framework, which is a whole set of different ethics, we start to see those cycles of abundance. If you want to take an economic example, let's look at, you know, circular economy. Let's look at developing products with a circular economy model so that there is minimum waste and maximum reuse of materials. Now, ultimately, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because we're running out of raw materials in the world. You know, the UK doesn't have its empire, and that's incredibly obvious by the lack of money washing around in the system. You know, we're no longer plundering other countries for our own wealth. So we have to reframe our entire economic system. We have to reframe how we do business for climate change, because climate change is not going to say, oh, top 2%, it's not going to affect you. It's going to affect all of us. It is the great sort of leveler of reality. Storms, hurricanes, wildfires, higher precipitation, drought, they're going to affect us all. We know that Credit Suisse have done a whole load of research around the cost of climate change, and it is trillions, and it will affect all businesses, not just the small people, all businesses. So really, we need to get into this place that is a wake-up call for everyone, and start to pick apart critically and with intellectual vigour the perpetual growth model and its shortcomings, and look differently at our future.
So the challenge that I see here is that it's the point you made about the top 2% piece, and I don't want to sound like a revolutionary Marxist here, but maybe I'm in danger of doing so, but I would say they're not likely to relinquish the controls, because, you know, that's not human nature. So what you've got is a small percentage of kind of focused financial power at the top of the system. And like I say, these are natural human drivers. I'm not saying anyone's evil. These are just the way the system has left the situation. And so whatever the threats to humans, whether it be war or climatic situations or whatever it is, those people at the very top are going to find ways, because they've got phenomenal resources in a way that has never been in history, has the disparity been so great, as far as I understand it. So they've got phenomenal resources to tell the story and sell the story in a way that benefits them. And they've also got, well, you could go down a rabbit hole of conspiracy theories or not conspiracy theories around digital currency and the control factors that introduces for power elites again. But what you end up with is a situation where well-meaning people like you or my parents are doing a good thing in terms of creating regenerative community on these small scale, and you'll be probably left in peace with that because it's not affecting the genuine power balance. But who is in a position to actually do what you're talking about, which is something, it's something kind of higher up the value chain in some way, isn't it? I'm not saying it's more valuable, but there's something there about flipping a system, because the people at the top are just going to make tweaks to a system and they're going to sell a story about how they've changed it. And, oh yeah, we're doing the right thing environmentally, you know, AKA greenwashing. Yeah, I guess that's my question. I'm not saying I expect you to be able to answer it. It's a bit of a hefty one.
It is a very hefty one, and I think really the only way the system will change is by its collapse. You know, it's like the USSR would not have changed if it hadn't economically collapsed. That's what brought the wall down. It wasn't revolution. It wasn't a rejection necessarily of Soviet communism. It was the disintegration of a financial system. And I think as the pressure points on the global climate intensify, which they, unfortunately, they will, in the next 50 years, It will be very, very difficult for that global elite to maintain and tweak business as usual, because the drivers that support that model will disintegrate. I mean, imagine if the Atlantic conveyor belt failed. You know, the UK would become a frozen country. It would have the same kind of climate as the Arctic Circle. And then that's going to bring enormous change. So, you know, it's not really about politics. It's about staring the potential reality in the face and saying, actually, yes, I am in control here as an elite, but I don't think life on Mars is a viable option. Perhaps I should put my resources into something a little bit more sensible and stop putting my head in the sand.
Well, let's hope you're right and that people see reason.
I think there are people in the world that have greater common sense than that. I don't want to ever maneuver myself into a place of them and us. I think, as you very rightly observed, there are people in the world who are just not quite aware of the depth of this crisis, and people that feel completely trapped in the system that we're in. But I think there are, and increasingly will be, people with power that think, I'm not a lemming, and I'm not going to run over the cliff with the others.
So, I mean, I definitely see a bigger and more imminent crisis than anything to do with climatic situations, and that is the potential for thermonuclear annihilation due to aging systems and human ego across the piece. So, but the thing is, for me, and I'll go back to the plant medicine experience, for me, I came to a place of great peace about all of this, because I reflected that I can't fix the sorrows of the world, as the meditation was that I was reflecting on at the time. All I can do is meet the sorrows of the world, whatever they may be, with my own version of kindness, love, whatever, as a coach. So I kind of came to a place of acceptance that I can't fix everything. I can only deal with whoever's in front of me in the kindest, most decent way I can. And that was incredibly relieving. Now, however, is that enough? Like, do you have a philosophical or religious, I guess that was a philosophical shift for me rather than a religious one. Do you have a philosophical or a religious kind of underpinning of how you think, or does it all come from your experience with the land? Where does it come from?
I think it comes from the kind of experiences that you've obviously had, the sense of deep sentience of other creatures, that we're not just the only living being with consciousness, that there are other species that are highly sentient and highly intelligent. It's just that their intelligence isn't the same as ours, and therefore we don't often recognize it. So my whole journey actually rested, and my change in what I did in my career rested on it sounds a little bit cliched, but it rested on an experience I had in Baja, Mexico, when I had a very close encounter with a grey whale. And I was on a small skiff in a lagoon, where the grey whales breed, and a whale surfaced right next to me. And I literally, within 4 feet, just over a meter, just looked into its eyes, and I instantly recognized that this was an ancient intelligence, and completely sentient, possibly in a different way to me, far more ancient and wiser than I was or I am. And that was life-changing for me, because when you see the sentience of other creatures, it's very difficult to then act unconsciously and in a destructive way. So from that point, I thought, I need to spend my life not even doing no harm in the Buddhist sense, but trying to seed out into the world. And it sounds a bit grandiose, but, you know, in my small way, positive, life-affirming, regenerative ways of living, and go on a big exploration, because I don't have the answers. Go and try and find out, how do we restore the land? How do we reintroduce biodiversity? How do we build harmonious human communities? How do we live in the world without destroying it?
Sorry, we had a glitch in the matrix there where the signal went. I was going to say, it's funny how both of us have put qualifiers in. I said something about if a CEO was listening, they might think it was a bit kind of hippie or something like that. And you said something about it feels grandiose to say that you're trying to seed these more sustainable ideas out into the world. But the funny thing is, neither of us should be ashamed of this, because if we were sitting here and we were both employees of Northrop Grumman or Raytheon, and we built weapons that went and mangled kids the other side of the world for whatever the latest campaign was, we wouldn't have any such problem in talking about our work. And so I rescind what I said. I think it's perfectly reasonable and not at all hippie woo-woo. And as for you being grandiose in trying to spread positive, sustainable ideas, no, I reject that. It's,
well, I know that we've reached millions of people through our YouTube channel. You know, we've sold hundreds of thousands of books in the last 30 years.
And no bombs. Some more. Never sold any bombs. Well done.
I have not made a bomb or sold one. No, not one armament has passed through my company. But I have won a Queen's Award for Enterprise, as it was then in 2008, Sustainable Development. So, you know, it has, to some extent, my work has been recognised.
Well, I'm recognising it, and thank you for the work you do. And if anyone would like to go and read that Permaculture magazine, which would it be the latest one? Where could people find
it? It is the latest one. So you can find it in some shops, or you can log on to permaculture.co.uk and click our shop link in the menu, and you'll navigate your way to Permaculture magazine. If you subscribe either to the paper version or digitally, you get access to our digital archives, which is 119 copies, and they're all searchable. So if you want to read something about agroforestry or
compost,
oh yeah, or nursing, or politics, or anything like that, you just put the subject matter in the search engine on the digital edition website, and you'll get all of our archives of 30 years free of charge.
Superb. Thank you, Maddie. Appreciate you coming on the podcast. And is there anything else, anywhere else people could connect with you, or is that not something you do? Instagram, LinkedIn, and any of those?
Yeah, I mean, Permaculture Magazine is on Instagram and Facebook and all the places, even on TikTok. You can also find me. I'm Maddie Harland, MaddyHarland. And you can find me on social media as well, on Instagram and Facebook mostly. And we're having a week, actually. It's Permaculture Week this week. So we've got guests from all over the world doing Instagram Live and sharing their gardens and their ideas and their techniques and their farming landscapes and their earth restoration work. So it's a good week to come and have a look for us.
Excellent. I'll aim to get this published tomorrow while it's still Permaculture Week.
And
really appreciate you coming on, and thank you for the work that you and Tim have done. And I'll catch up with you another time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Bye, Maddie.
Bye-bye.